Κρατικό πιστοποιητικό γλωσσομάθειας. Αγγλική γλώσσα. Τρίτη ενότητα. Εξέταση κατανόησης προφορικού λόγου. Έναρξη της εξέτασης.
Part A. Activity 1. Read items 1A and 2A. Listen twice and choose the best answer A, B or C for each item.
Archaeologists in Peru have unearthed a royal tomb crammed with treasures and mummified women from about 1200 years ago. They say the discovery will help piece together the life of the Huari Empire, which ruled in the Andes before the rise of the better-known Inca civilization. More than 60 skeletons were uncovered inside the tomb, including three Huari queens, buried with gold and silver jewellery and brilliantly painted ceramics. Forensic archaeologist Vyacheslav Vikovsky said the way the bodies were positioned indicates human sacrifice.
Listen again and check your answers.
Archaeologists in Peru have unearthed a royal tomb crammed with treasures and mummified women from about 1200 years ago. They say the discovery will help piece together the life of the Huari Empire, which ruled in the Andes before the rise of the better-known Inca civilization. More than 60 skeletons were uncovered inside the tomb, including three Huari queens, buried with gold and silver jewellery and brilliantly painted ceramics. Forensic archaeologist Vyacheslav Vikovsky said the way the bodies were positioned indicates human sacrifice.
Read items 3A and 4A. Listen twice and choose the best answer, A, B or C, for each item.
Finally tonight, a special kind of song. Leonard Bernstein once said that music can name the unnameable, communicate the unknowable. And our doctor in residence is exploring the remarkable difference music is making in neonatal intensive care units, keeping the tiniest patients alive.
In a medical unit for those born too soon, tiny preemies struggle to breathe, to eat, to survive. And something as old as mankind is helping them do it. Here at New York Presbyterian and in hospitals across the country, the relentless beeping of monitors fades when music takes over. The effect isn't just dramatic, it's physical. Research done here shows that this gentle music therapy not only slows the heart, it helps babies sleep and feed better, gain weight, and other studies show the babies leave the hospital sooner.
Listen again and check your answers.
Finally tonight, a special kind of song. Leonard Bernstein once said that music can name the unnameable, communicate the unknowable. And our doctor in residence is exploring the remarkable difference music is making in neonatal intensive care units, keeping the tiniest patients alive.
In a medical unit for those born too soon, tiny preemies struggle to breathe, to eat, to survive. And something as old as mankind is helping them do it. Here at New York Presbyterian and in hospitals across the country, the relentless beeping of monitors fades when music takes over. The effect isn't just dramatic, it's physical. Research done here shows that this gentle music therapy not only slows the heart, it helps babies sleep and feed better, gain weight, and other studies show the babies leave the hospital sooner.
Activity 2. Read items 5A to 7A. Listen twice and choose the best answer, A, B, or C, for each item.
Thank you. Now there is a new book called Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots by Deborah Feldman. This is her own experience. This is not registering any opinion about Hasidic Jews. But you left that community, and it was very difficult for you. Tell us what your life was like as a Hasidic child and what the rules were.
Okay, well, for starters, the education is so different for young Hasidic girls because we don't go to regular schools. We go to religious private schools. And in those schools, we learn things like prayer and the laws of modesty and the laws of kosher. And we learn how to sew and how to be good housewives. And we get the rudimentary basics of secular education, but not enough to get us accredited for a diploma. Mm. So most girls graduate at age 16 with, I would say, a fourth grade reading level.
And their whole life has to be the husband.
Well, yeah, you're being trained to marry, have children, and run a very efficient home because you're expected to have a lot of children. So you spend your life, instead of, say, reading books or watching TV and movies or listening to music or playing sports, instead you're at home helping to care for siblings, nieces, nephews.
Listen again and check your answers.
Now there is a new book called Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots by Deborah Feldman. This is her own experience. This is not registering any opinion about Hasidic Jews. But you left that community, and it was very difficult for you. Tell us what your life was like as a Hasidic child and what the rules were.
Okay, well, for starters, the education is so different for young Hasidic girls because we don't go to regular schools. We go to religious private schools, and in those schools we learn things like prayer and the laws of modesty and the laws of kosher, and we learn how to sew and how to be good housewives. And we get the rudimentary basics of secular education, but not enough to get us accredited for a diploma. Mm. So most girls graduate at age 16 with, I would say, a fourth grade reading level.
And their whole life has to be the husband.
Well, yeah, you're being trained to marry, have children, and run a very efficient home because you're expected to have a lot of children. So you spend your life, instead of, say, reading books or watching TV and movies or listening to music or playing sports, instead you're at home helping to care for siblings, nieces, nephews.
Read items 8A to 10A. Listen twice and choose the best answer, A, B, or C, for each item.
You're at home helping to care for siblings, nieces, nephews.
And lots of children.
Lots and lots of children, yes.
Also, one of the things I didn't know was in the Hasidic community, you are taught to trust only Hasidics, not even the police. So how was that?
You know, I think that comes from the fact that the community was founded by Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. And there was this idea that, you know, never trust an outsider because they had seen their neighbors mm-hmm. turn on them in times mm-hmm. of war. And I was taught from a very young age that no matter how nice an outsider pretended to be, he hated you, or she hated you, no matter what.
It's also customary in the Hasidic community for marriages to be arranged, is that correct? And yours was, you met your future husband just once before your wedding day, and you were only 17.
That is
correct. Can you take us back to that day?
I can only tell you that I was absolutely terrified, because I had never before had a strange conversation with a man, and I thought men were a separate species, and I had no idea how to understand them. Mm. And I spent the entire conversation nervous and jittery, and I couldn't focus, and I couldn't remember a word after.
Did you feel like life was beginning or your life was over? Like, how do you feel as a young woman about to...
I felt in a twilight moment.
Okay. And at one point, you said, I've got to get out of here. You already had a child. You had a son. How did you ever get out to be the woman you are today?
To escape the sort of microscopic lens of the community, I moved to a liberal Jewish community upstate because it was too stressful. With my husband. It was too stressful for both of us.
Yeah.
So at that point, I was already learning to drive and breaking all these rules because I was living outside of Williamsburg. And so I started sneaking out to go to Sarah Lawrence College, and I didn't tell anyone in my family or my community because I knew if anyone found out, they would pressure me to stop.
Listen again and check your answers.
You're at home helping to care for siblings, nieces, nephews.
And lots of children.
Lots and lots of children, yes.
Also, one of the things I didn't know was in the Hasidic community, you are taught to trust only Hasidics, not even the police. So how was that?
You know, I think that comes from the fact that the community was founded by Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. And there was this idea that, you know, never trust an outsider because they had seen their neighbors mm-hmm. turn on them in times mm-hmm. of war. And I was taught from a very young age that no matter how nice an outsider pretended to be, he hated you or she hated you, no matter what.
It's also customary in the Hasidic community for marriages to be arranged, is that correct? And yours was, you met your future husband just once before your wedding day and you were only 17.
That is
correct. Can you take us back to that day?
I can only tell you that I was absolutely terrified because I had never before had a strange conversation with a man, and I thought men were a separate species and I had no idea how to understand them. Mm. And I spent the entire conversation nervous and jittery, and I couldn't focus, and I don't remember, like, I couldn't remember a word after.
Did you feel like life was beginning or your life was over? Like, how do you feel as a young woman about to...
I felt in a twilight moment.
Okay. And at one point you said, I've got to get out of here. You already had a child, you had a son. How did you ever get out to be the woman you are today?
To escape the sort of microscopic lens of the community, I moved to a liberal Jewish community upstate because it was too stressful.
With your husband?
With my husband. It was too stressful for both of us.
Yeah.
So at that point, I was already learning to drive and breaking all these rules because I was living outside of Williamsburg. And so I started sneaking out to go to Sarah Lawrence College, and I didn't tell anyone in my family or my community because I knew if anyone found out, they would pressure me to stop.
Activity 3. Read items 11A to 14A. Listen once and choose the best answer, A, B, or C, for each item.
Earth and sky.
The discovery of the heaviest element ever seen in a distant galaxy, thorium, should let astronomers begin to use a new technique for finding the ages of stars in other galaxies.
They'll do this in the same way geologists measure the age of rocks, via radioactive dating. Radioactive thorium decays over time, so the older a rock or a star, the less thorium it'll have. By comparing the amount of thorium with the abundance of other elements, scientists can figure out the ages of rocks or stars.
Japanese astronomers looked at the star COS 82 in a small galaxy external to our own Milky Way. Analysis of its light revealed the element thorium and let astronomers date this star. Their rough estimate of 13 billion years placed COS 82 in the same age range as the oldest stars in our galaxy.
The uncertainty in the estimate is high, and the astronomers admit they could be off on this star's age by as much as 6 billion years. Well, now they want to search for another radioactive element, uranium, within this very distant star. That'll help them pinpoint the accuracy to just 2 billion years. Quite a feat for a star outside our Milky Way's boundaries.
Activity 4. Read items 15A to 17A. Listen once and choose the best answer, A, B, or C, for each item.
A mere 7 years after my graduation day, I had failed on an epic scale. An exceptionally short-lived marriage had imploded, and I was jobless, a lone parent, and as poor as it is possible to be in modern Britain without being homeless. The fears that my parents had had for me and that I had had for myself had both come to pass. And by every usual standard, I was the biggest failure I knew. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that failure is fun. That period of my life was a dark one. And I had no idea that there was going to be what the press has since represented as a kind of fairy tale resolution. I had no idea then how far the tunnel extended, and for a long time, any light at the end of it was a hope rather than a reality. So why do I talk about the benefits of failure? Simply because failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was.
Read items 18A to 20A. Listen once and choose the best answer, A, B, or C, for each item.
I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was, and began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. Had I really succeeded at anything else, I might never have found the determination to succeed in the one arena where I believed I truly belonged. I was set free, because my greatest fear had been realized, and I was still alive, and I still had a daughter whom I adored, and I had an old typewriter and a big idea. And so rock bottom became the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life. You might never fail on the scale I did, but some failure in life is inevitable. It is impossible to live without failing at something, unless you live so cautiously that you might as well not have lived at all, in which case you fail by default. Failure gave me an inner security that I had never attained by passing examinations. Failure taught me things about myself that I could have learned no other way. I discovered that I had a strong will and more discipline than I had suspected. I also found out that I had friends whose value was truly above the price of rubies. The knowledge that you have emerged wiser and stronger from setbacks means that you are, ever after, secure in your ability to survive. You will never truly know yourself or the strength of your relationships until both have been tested by adversity. Such knowledge is a true gift.
Part B. Activity 1. Read items 1B to 5B. Listen twice and fill in the gaps.
Today's great life is known to horticulturalists as the father of the English flower garden. A champion of the wild garden, William Robinson was a radical and persuasive writer and designer whose influence on British gardens has been compared to that of William Morris on interiors. His ideas on gardening, formulated in the late 19th century, are more popular today than ever. According to a recent review, we are all Robinsonians now, even if we don't know it. You might not recognise Robinson's name, but whether you know it or not, you've seen his philosophy in action in gardens around the country, and you're very likely to know his nominator, my guest today, the garden expert, star of Gardener's World, Carol Klein. Carol, would you count yourself a Robinsonian?
Listen again and check your answers.
Today's great life is known to horticulturalists as the father of the English flower garden. A champion of the wild garden, William Robinson was a radical and persuasive writer and designer whose influence on British gardens has been compared to that of William Morris on interiors. His ideas on gardening, formulated in the late 19th century, are more popular today than ever. According to a recent review, we are all Robinsonians now, even if we don't know it. You might not recognise Robinson's name, but whether you know it or not, you've seen his philosophy in action in gardens around the country. And you're very likely to know his nominator, my guest today, the garden expert, star of Gardener's World, Carol Klein. Carol, would you count yourself a Robinsonian?
Activity 2. Read items 6B to 10B. Listen once and fill in the gaps.
So let's move on now to another Cartesian topic, dualism. This is certainly the view for which Descartes is now best known. If you find the word Cartesian in a philosophical text, the most likely accompaniment is the word dualism. Cartesian dualism is fairly straightforwardly stated. He takes the body to be material, made of matter whose essence is extension. And he takes the mind to be made of a completely different substance, immaterial substance, non-material, whose essence is thinking. So we've got two distinct substances. Now that's very important. Notice, to be a Cartesian dualist, it's not enough that you just think mind and body are different, or even that mind and body have different properties. You've got to think that they're different substances. And that is a very substantial claim. Now, in the Discourse on Method, Descartes argues something like this. I can doubt that my body exists. I cannot doubt that I exist. Therefore, I am not identical with my body. Quite a tempting argument, at least, to start with. Put yourself in the position of the skeptic. What can I be sure of? Well, the only thing I can be sure of is my own thoughts and my own perceptions. So I'm absolutely certain that I exist, but when I contemplate my body, if it's all an illusion, I cannot be sure that my body exists. Surely then my mind and my body must be distinct things. For example, I can imagine myself transported maybe to an afterlife or something like that, in which I don't have a body, but I still think. I can imagine myself in that situation. So surely I and my body must be distinct things. It seems quite plausible.
λήξη της εξέτασης.